Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon. Okay. Go ahead.
That was the voice of our founder and mentor, Brian Brown. You're listening to The Brown Briefly, and it is Tuesday, August 4th, 2020, in the year of the tweet and the global pandemic. That sounds like a rooster. Not only is it Louis Armstrong's birthday, it's also Barack Obama's birthday. So happy birthday to the guy we wish was still president. With us this morning and all alone in the Gene Boss studio in bustling and bodacious downtown Vachon, while the rest of us lounge comfortably at home in our PJs, zooming into the show is our master of the virtual mix and Zoom modulating sound engineer, Truman O'Brien. Good morning, Truman.
Good morning. Gosh, I've had a few technical difficulties this morning.
It's been one of those days. Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, sometimes it's my finger on the big red switch in the wrong big red switch. And sometimes it's just the darn technology. So, you know.
And yet we remain airborne, Truman.
So yeah, we're still flying on. Here we are.
Yes, we are. That was the voice of Lynn Carrigan coming to us from somewhere in old Vachon.
Somewhere down in Ellisport. Hey, Truman, I wanted to say that is one of my top 10 favorite tunes that you just played.
Louis Armstrong's.
What a Wonderful World. I once made a death tape when I was terribly upset and blue. And by the time I was done, having recorded all my favorite songs onto one mixtape, that being the end song, except for the frogs that I played.
Yes.
I was no longer depressed.
Well, there you go. You know, I'll throw in a little story too. I joined the, I'll say it in a minute, North Shore community band. That's not right. Anyway, it was a community band, and we would practice every Monday night, and I would come home from work. I'd be incredibly tired, and I'd think, oh, I just can't go to band practice tonight, but I'd drag myself up there. I would come home just jazzed, you know? It's amazing what that music gives energy. Yeah, it does. There you go. Shoreline Community Band. I finally thought of the name. Duh.
There you go.
All right.
And highly visible on our Zoom screen this morning is the Phantom Editor of Indivisible Vachon's weekly online newsletter for your consideration, Kevin Jones. Kevin, you have got so much to talk about today with the election upcoming and all the rumors and obstructions and so forth. So we might start with you, especially since two of our group have yet to join us. They are Bruce Hallman and Michael Shook. I don't know where they are, but
they're probably unmoored from the earth completely, not knowing what day or time it is. And they're just soaring aloft. Maybe they'll land and maybe they won't.
Well, is today the day that Bruce is going to be gone, or was that last week? Oh, wait, there's Michael.
There's Michael.
Hey, there he is.
Where am I?
Hey,
Michael.
Coming to us from his home perch is erstwhile presidential candidate, literary carpenter, and singing gardener Michael Shook, sometimes known as Chauncey or for some reason Tet. What has struck you this week in conversation with the sharp-witted Cynthia or while you're digging in the dirt, Michael?
Boy, oh boy, that's a good question. Many things struck me, among them branches.
Loose boards, nails.
We watched a film last night, Recount, with Kevin Spacey and Laura Dern, Tom Wilkinson's wonderful cast, very well produced, and it was made in 2008. It was about the recount in Florida. and
Hanging Chad thing.
Oh,
Al Gore's.
Just made my, you know, it made my blood run cold looking at it, because I realized that so many aspects of our election system are just so, if they're not confusing, they're outdated. If they're not outdated, they're being run by such extraordinarily partisan groups. And that applies on the left as well as the right. Although I have to say, from my view, the right has been unconscionable in the way that they have purged voter rolls and things like that, and shut down polling stations, and all this came out in the film. It was just like like reliving a nightmare. I'm not quite sure why I watched it.
We're going to talk a lot more about that today, but first I would like to mention that he is here from somewhere in Old Vashon, our resident historian and guardian of the galaxy, Bruce Hallman, who tries to bring us the long-range view of all the chaos we're living through, and regularly reminds us that while the grinding wheels of justice may take time, that's okay, True.
They eventually get bastards
in the end. Bruce, is there still hope that'll work?
Oh, there's always hope, right? Yes, right. And, you know, in the election thing, I mean, you know, American elections have never been free and open elections. You know, we've been working to get there for generations. And, you know, it's ebb and flow, if you will. But right now, we're at the cusp of the possibility of sort of moving to the point where we become a true democracy rather than a Republican democracy, little r Republican democracy, which was what the founders wanted. Not everybody could vote. Not everybody was eligible to vote. And we're moving in a direction where all of a sudden being a citizen is all it takes to be able to vote. And then, like Michael said, I mean, knocking down the barriers, the artificial barriers to that kind of true democracy. So I'm hopeful, but it's going to be a struggle.
Yeah, man, we have a lot to talk about today. I am Susan McCabe, the democratically appointed moderator for today's Brown Briefly. And I want us to start, I think, with the Washington state primary election. Ballots are due today. And here in Washington, everybody mails in their ballots, absentee or not.
Fraudulent, corrupted.
Yeah. Oh, you know, it's just, you know, it's going to be just a mess. We've only been doing it for what, 3 years, 4 years now?
Yeah, right. Well, yeah. Among you, who knows how difficult it is going to be, number one, to ramp up other states into mail-in balloting, and number two, to save the post office so that can actually happen.
Nevada just passed. They're going to be all mail-in. They did it about, what, 2 days ago? So there you go. But no, Nevada, the state of Nevada. Yeah, they just passed it.
Good.
Monday night, I believe.
Yeah, and Trump said, oh, yeah, I'm going to sue him right away, you know, blah, blah, blah.
It's terrifying.
You know, it's interesting to me because we've been working hard to get people to sign up for absentee ballots. And now some states have decided with COVID that they're going to be mailing applications out to people. So I know for sure that Georgia, unless their governor turns this thing off, Wisconsin, Michigan, I believe, and Wisconsin are now both also sending out absentee ballot requests. California is working to get to universal, just like Washington State. A lot of states are moving in this direction now.
And aren't there five states already that do nothing but absentee balloting? We are one of five, I believe, that have already gone.
Washington, Oregon, Arizona.
Mail-in ballots, yeah. Which to me provides such a better safety record. There's a handwritten signed copy of what you turned in. It doesn't just turn into something abstract in a numbered voting machine that, you know, as we know, because they hacked Georgia's and other states, the computer election system during the 2016 elections. That was two of the states that I can remember that were hacked by the Russians.
Yeah, so, Lynn, weren't there discrepancies in, if I may be having this wrong, but I think Ohio too, there were a number of votes that just disappeared.
I think that happened as well, but I know that they found it in Georgia and one other state. It could have been Ohio. I don't know. But those, machines were a lot more, to me, susceptible of being hacked, even though you had to go into each state's mainframe to do it. It seems like with written ballots, the old-fashioned way, less is more.
One of the things King County has done, and I think most of Washington State is doing that at this point, is none of the computers that put together the election results are connected to the internet. They're all standalone systems, so there's no way they can be hacked. And that's why Washington is a real model for the rest of the country in terms of how to handle online voting. It's free, the pre-stamped envelopes, so it doesn't cost anything to mail. You don't have to stand in line. Registration, you can register up to the day of the election. Washington State is a real pathfinder into this future of what democracy in the United States can be.
And you don't have to take time from your work day. I know that that's a huge issue for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. To have it on a weekday. And so you're at work, you get off of work at, 4:30 or 5 or something. And then the traffic isn't what it used to be now. But for a lot of folks, that was a real challenge. Am I going to be able to get to the polling place before it closes at 8? It's just ridiculous. So the mail-in is a no-brainer.
Well, and haven't there been attempts to make voting day a national holiday? Wouldn't that make sense?
Yeah. Ruth,
what do you know about that?
Yeah, there's proposals to do that. In both Australia and New Zealand, which I'm much more familiar with, number one, they have an electoral commission. So they have a national nonpartisan electoral commission that runs all elections. Everything from local elections to national elections, and they're all run in the same way in every district in all through the country. So in the United States, in Washington State, every county runs its own elections, and multiply that by 50 states, by however many counties. There's thousands and thousands of different ways to vote in the United States. Australia, New Zealand, one way, and it's run by an appointed a nonpartisan commission, and they vote on Saturdays, and it is a holiday. So it's very accessible.
Seems to me that does get rid of the barrier, one of the barriers about not being able to get to your polling place without losing your job, or losing money from your job. Sure. But the thing that I think a lot about, which is now being raised in the new John Lewis Voting Rights Bill, is to put back federal oversight of some of the election processes that are going on in the states. For example, some of the southern states, when they lifted those federal oversight laws, right, just started closing a number of polls so that they were restricting where people had to go. Some had to go for hours and wait for hours. Mm-hmm. So I think that, the new voting rights law that kind of puts back authority for somebody to ride herd on some of the independence of some of the local electoral boards, need to be there.
And we keep hearing from election commissioners over and over again that voter fraud is infinitesimally present in any of our elections. And given complexity of our electoral system, as you described it, Bruce, I'm amazed that in the past we've managed to get final answer on voting day. Kevin?
I think that the percentage of actual confirmed fraudulent voting is like 0.00006%, something like that, right? I also, it's really intriguing because we're supporting voters across the country in important states like Georgia, et cetera, Arizona. And, we're so fortunate to live in Washington State. Georgia, for example, says it could take 2 to 4 weeks for them to acknowledge your application for to register to vote. If you go to their website, could take 2 to 4 weeks. In Arizona, I believe it is, I just looked this up, that their last day to register to vote before the November 3rd election is October 5th. So you can just see the kind of disparities we have. And in Washington state, I had the good fortune to hear Gail Tarleton, who's running for Secretary of State, say that, you know, we shouldn't be satisfied in Washington that 60% of our residents vote on a good election turnout. We have postage free, you know, the ballot arrives in the mail. What's going on with the 40%? And her push is that we just haven't educated, have not educated voters who've moved here from other states with these really restrictive voting laws to let them know they're now in this nirvana of voting and that they really now, it's so easy, they should step in and make sure their voice is heard.
And I love the idea in New Zealand is you're fined if you don't vote. It's compulsory that you vote. You're fined if you're not voted. It's a minimum fine, $50 or something like that. But the expectation is, and there, you know, there's provisions for, you know, if you're out of the country or traveling or you're ill, or, I mean, there's lots of provisions, but they get 96, 97% turnout for every election, whether it's a local election or a national election. I mean, so it's doable.
So this makes me think of, I remember my daughter had this wonderful teacher in about second grade, my older daughter, and I was amazed at what the kids did. And I was talking with her, and God bless her, she retired that year. We needed to clone her or something. But I said, how is it that, you know, these kids are doing all these things? And she said, well, I set the bar high. And then the expectation that I have for them is that they can achieve it. My job is to show them whatever ways I can to help them realize that they can achieve it. And, you know, it was a great system. And, you know, what you've said, Kevin and Bruce there about voting, we need to raise that bar and have the expectation, teach the expectation that this is one of the duties and responsibilities of being a good citizen. It's just like you don't drive your car 70 miles an hour through downtown Vashon because it's irresponsible and you could harm people. I mean, that's an expectation.
I think sometimes people have confused it, and the same thing with the I have a right not to wear a mask issue, which is, I think sometimes people are thinking of it as a zero-sum game. Well, my votes never count, or I never get to win with the people that I vote for, so what does it matter if I vote? Mm-hmm. You know, I think that is such short-sighted thinking as opposed to the power it shows when there's a huge turnout and people express their will.
Yeah.
You know, I love Bruce's description of Australia, where it's a centralized system and everyone is expected to vote. In this country, how possible is it going to be to get to that point when there are so many folks working to obstruct voting in so many ways, including gerrymandering and intimidations at the polls, and now letting the Postal Service go bankrupt. And the other question I have that maybe you can answer, Kevin, is one of the things I've heard that makes me nervous about this November election is that if the states do not ratify their elections, especially if mail-in voting lengthens the time for counting, if the states do not ratify their elections by sometime in early December, their votes don't count. What do you know about that?
You know, I don't have the exact information about that, but I think that was one of these scenarios that was published by the editors of Newsweek. About how the current president could lose both the national popular vote and the electoral college vote and still remain in office by ramping up the legal challenges And the groundwork, of course, has already been set. So ramping up the legal challenges to the election results, delaying the election results. And there was like this, a dozen steps in this sort of lengthy process that this could happen. The one fundamental thing that enabled it is if the vote was close. So if you have a huge surge for the other candidate, which is like Joe Biden at this point, this process, according to the Newsweek editors, cannot work. It just wouldn't be viable. You don't have a leg to stand on in the courts. So the message I'm sending out is don't give up your right to vote and have your voice heard, because there are ways that this guy can stay in office, even if the popular vote in Electoral College is, if he loses both of them.
Bruce.
Sinister, you're cynic.
Bruce, what do you do? I remember reading in the old days, I mean, going back to the early 1800s, some of those elections, it would take weeks for them, sometimes even, a couple of months.
Oh, yeah, right.
And we seem to be able to manage that.
Yeah, well, I mean, you got to remember up until, I'm trying to think, it's post-World War II, the president wasn't inaugurated until the end of March. So Franklin D. Roosevelt didn't become president until March of 1932. You know, they moved it up after World War II to now in January. And partly because improvement to mail, improvement of communications, that kind of stuff, election results. I mean, 200 years ago, election results were by horseback. the country wasn't as big, but still, it took time. And so gradually what you've seen is a system emerge that is reflective of the technologies available. What's not happened is we've not moved to a point where everybody does mail-in voting. Everything's basically tabulated within a few days, and the results are indisputable. And that's what I think people with election reforms are working toward. You know, the fact that we get out of this sort of 18th century model that we're in of how votes are counted and come into the 21st century.
Ken.
I think there's will be a really intriguing dynamic play out here, and I don't know how it's going to work out, but there is such a huge emphasis on getting people to request absentee ballots or vote by mail and do that early, right? Because we know about these risks. We know about the post office delays and the funding cuts and so on. And so I am hoping that what will happen is we're going to see a outsized portion of the electorate voting by mail, doing so early, getting those ballots into the election centers where they can be counted. Whether they actually start counting them before election day, I don't know. But I think that the lagging indicator will be those who still choose to actually go to the polls. Mm-hmm. And so it'll be very intriguing to me to see what the early indications tell us from those voters who are doing vote by mail.
And also doing a lot of encouragement to get people to put them in local drop boxes. You know, that's another way to avoid the mail, but it also lands the ballots, to be counted the day after the election. And the thing I want to add to Susan's concern about the post office and all that is, I'm familiar with the regulation about you need to get your ballot postmarked by, the day of the election. But I am hearing that some places in Texas in particular, it has to be received by the day of the election, or some states like no later than a week out. And I didn't know that. I thought that was just as long as it was postmarked, they could trickle in whenever. And so that's another, challenge there. What?
I said, I bet the voters are not aware of that either. And that's, of course, the issue. And then we have Trump's new Postal Service czar, whatever, executive director, creating more restrictions on mail delivery that he says are for efficiencies, but what's actually happening is it's slowing down the mail and piling up.
Yeah, I saw that because I'm at the end of a run here down in Ellisport, and I'm always seeing them leave with, you know, their loads still in the car because it's the end of the shift.
Right.
You know, all these new things, they can't work overtime anymore. They have to go back. Kevin.
So I'll have to relay a story because Louis DeJoy, I believe, is the Trump crony's name who's now in charge of the Postal Service. Right. And in For Your Consideration last week, I think it was the recommendation was to leave a complaint with the Postal Service about this cutting of overtime and the risk that mail doesn't get moved. And so it's a little challenging to fill out the paperwork because you put in your contact and then which post office did you have the complaint with? And you know, and who's the person you're complaining? So I said, Postmaster Louis DeJoy, right? So anyway, I sent that off, I don't know, 3 or 4 days ago. 2 days later, I get this, I get home and I get a voicemail on my phone and I listen to it. And it's from the Vashon Post Office saying, we're going to get you your mail on time. Don't worry. And I thought, okay,
wow.
So the post office is actually responding to my complaint, but they sort of missed the entire idea. Yeah. Of what the concern was.
No, they didn't. Isn't that the usual standard operating procedure? Just roll that ball downhill.
Well, they didn't engage to challenge the person at the top who's setting the regulation.
I got that.
Of course, I kind of expected, yeah. But.
Yeah, they take a risk doing that. They risk their jobs doing that.
Yeah, and I thought the post office that I, in my complaint, I said I used the Washington, D.C. Post office zip code as the post office of concern, thinking that would like land closer to home.
I know.
Unfortunately, what I ended up doing, is adding more workload to our local postmaster who had to make this foolish phone call when I was complaining.
No good deed goes unpunished, Kevin.
Exactly. So we need to find another way. But yes, it's really disturbing that this is going on. And the suggestion that, you know, FedEx and other UPS get together to help out the Postal Service has also become sort of a discussion. But I just think the logistics of that are just very challenging and probably not likely to happen, although at least is being discussed.
It seems to me if we could get our legislators to rescind that provision that the post office pay health care for their workers 75 years in advance every year, that's what's causing the post office to go bankrupt. That's what's removing all profits. I've written letters to my legislators to tell them to address that law to no avail.
Say that again. They have to pay in for health care 7 years out.
They have to fund everything,
including
pension and retirement funds for each year. So it creates this enormous cash flow problem. There isn't a private business in the country that funds retirements or pension funds or anything. The Carpenters Union has for decades, since their inception, they've never funded their pension and retirement funds that way. It goes into a fund. It kind of works sort of like Social Security. The guys who are still their money is going into, their contributions are going into the fund. Part of that is helping to pay for my pension and retirement fund. The post office, this is a one-off, and the Republicans knew exactly what they were doing when they enacted it because they want to get their hands on all that mail and package delivery and privatize it.
Right. The post office is having to pay for employees that are not even working for them yet.
Right.
That's how ridiculous this law is. I think it was passed in 2006. Is that correct, Michael?
I don't know the exact date, but it's just.
Since the passage of that law, the post office has struggled financially. So their agenda is working. Kevin.
Yeah, this warning, this warning, Michael, that you posed, which is very valid about privatization, is, of course, not limited to the post office. It's charter schools, for example, infrastructure where we build toll roads instead of freeways, I'm
prison
now reading
industries.
The prison, absolutely, privatization of prisons. I'm now reading this Democracy in Chains, which I should have read. It came out in 2017. I should have read it 2 years ago. It talks about the elite, the protection of property rights in America and how important it is to protect property rights. And property in this case means billionaires and their money, right? And all the stuff that they own. And the idea that a majority can tell these people how they have to spend their money, like taxes to fund schools and freeways, just shouldn't be allowed. And the think tanks that have been working on this, back to Calhoun and Buchanan are some of the two founding names, have built very elaborate arguments about how democracy, how do they put it? Economics should be protected from democracy, meaning that the really rich should not have to pay attention to the ruling of the majority, and they should be given outsized rights. And so privatization is enabling, right, more and more things that get privatized then become property of the wealthy, and therefore they should be exempt from democracy. It's a startling, shocking book.
What's happening? You know, the move towards oligarchies and corporations that stand outside of government control. It's a balance of government and economics. You know, they're not the same thing, and it's not either or. We're going to be in trouble if they hoodwink us that we can't tell that difference.
And it's a return to kind of feudalism, where the lord of the manor
absolutely
he didn't pay taxes directly to the king. He collected it from all of the people who were living on, quote, his property, his land, and just kept squeezing them dry. This is an interesting example. There is a con man who, this killed me, because I saw this in the paper one day. There's a con man who built some pretty wealthy people in Texas out of hundreds of thousands of dollars that eventually escalated up into over $1 million. He was living quite a lifestyle, and you have to kind of give him credit for his chutzpah to be able to pull it off. But when he was finally convicted for about the fourth time, he was given a sentence of 144 years, and he's being held. He's eligible for parole next year. He's being held in a maximum security section of the prison, where he is isolated for 23 hours a day and is allowed that 1 hour a day to go out of his cell and exercise outside and everything, take a shower and that kind of thing. But he has no contact other than that except with a guard or somebody. So in contrast, there was a story in the paper the other day about a woman who died. She was one of the first partial face transplants in our country. She received that after her abusive husband shot her in the face trying to kill her. Okay, he attempted to murder her. He got 7 years. 7 years. And I said to Cynthia, I said, this is a little microcosm of what our culture really values. You can attempt to kill someone in a horribly brutal way and get 7 years. He's probably out on parole after four. But if you steal, you know, and it was theft. I'm not saying it was okay. But if you take money, just stuff, no one was physically harmed. No damage was done to buildings or anything. These guys recovered a massive amount of their money. You know, he got 144 years.
Because he didn't steal from a corner grocery store. He stole from rich people.
Yes.
His big mistake.
Yeah.
Ah. Do armed robbery of a 7-Eleven and get.
Oh, yeah.
And especially Adam Smith, the wealth of nations.
Right. Truman. Ah.
Well, no, go ahead, Kevin. Go ahead.
Well, and I was going to say, of course, you know, the rich and well-connected get the light sentences, as is Stone and Flynn and et cetera. We're watching that play out, but.
What I was going to point out was I saw this earlier. I didn't find the thing I was looking for, but I was comparing FedEx, UPS, and USPS rates, right? And if you look at priority mail, USPS is $10.74, and that's compared to $16 for UPS or $18 for FedEx. If you go to the priority mail small flat box, USPS $7, FedEx $14, double cost. Same with a lightweight package, USPS $3.82, UPS $10.72 or $13 for FedEx. So there you go. I mean, that's what we're looking at right now.
The cost of privatization.
There you go.
Right.
Yeah. Same with ferry system, right? Somebody has to make a buck as opposed to it being publicly owned. Yep. And the argument is it's less efficient. It's government. I think the reality is that you don't have to pay somebody's for somebody's big boat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Mm. Anybody?
Another thing I read too about that is with privatization, companies they increase their service to areas that are wealthy that can afford to pay all that stuff. So if you're poor or you're living way out, 18 miles from somewhere, like my brother and sister-in-law, you're going to get crummy service and have to pay exorbitantly more. So it's another way of squeezing people who are less economically advantaged.
You know, I'm pondering your reference to feudalism, Michael, and thinking about hoping that things are different now since the Industrial Revolution, when we don't necessarily live on the Lord's property. So they can't necessarily take our homes away. So what if we stopped working for them? That somewhere along the line in the Industrial Revolution, the magnates forgot that their empires don't function without people to work in them. And they decided that that either they don't need us or they don't need to care about whether we are healthy and happy and cared for. Any comments on that? What happened?
It was an exchange. I mean, it was a move from an exchange economy to a cash economy. I mean, that's the big sort of a movement that took place. In feudalism and in a lot of traditional societies, they're exchange economies. I mean, you work for somebody, or you work on the land, you get a part of it. Part of it goes to the owner of the land or the lord in the manor or whatever. When those systems collapsed, what developed was a wage economy. So labor became valued by currencies, let's say, and it's the emergence of currencies. I mean, feudal times, you really didn't have currencies. I mean, rich people had gold bars and that kind of stuff and jewels and things, but common people had very little of value other than their labor. And their labor was paid for basically by exchange of goods. Once you create an exchange economy that's based on currencies, then labor becomes valued. And that's where you get into this sort of where we are now, where a minimum wage is not a survivable wage.
We also socially, though, moved away from a couple of other things that I'm thinking about. One, we went from sort of manufactured goods to the information technology world, where people are now, developing all kinds of fictions and alternative facts, and you better be a high-rolling banker to be able to be making short trades and all that pretty quickly. And we became global instead of community-oriented in any factories that were in our hometowns, employing our local people. So it seems to me that there have been a number of changes, or houses of cards that I like to think of it as, a number of things that have threatened what some of us who are old enough to remember kind of a more stable time probably reaped in that golden bubble post-World War II, where we grew up. where everybody could afford to be educated publicly, and you know, the roads infrastructure was going in. I began to think of it as quite a bubble time for us, you know, kind of a golden time.
Kevin.
Interesting question you pose, Susan, about why would we continue to work for them? And a couple of thoughts comes along, but you know, people evaluating different employers for how fair they are as a way to say, I'm going to leave this employer, go to that employer. It also, those who don't have that mobility, right, kind of the notion of a general strike comes up. And of course, that is why in this book that I'm reading, Democracy in Chains, there's such a huge movement against unions and collective bargaining. And the fact that this collective bargaining is not to be allowed in the democracy that the really truly wealthy desire, because that just puts a limit on their ability to acquire wealth. And the you know, right to work states and all of those other laws that came about to restrict the ability of folks to unionize and to pull together, even to you know, demonstrate and work collaboratively in that dimension, are all things that are threatened by this mindset. And some of those successes have been, you know, we see them. We see those capabilities being removed now.
Yeah, and under COVID, under the pandemic right now, the Republicans are fighting the idea of supporting people with unemployment because they're afraid they won't go back to work. That could kind of constitute a general strike if indeed everyone was able. I suspect that's a fear of the Republicans. They're afraid that people won't want to go back to work for them and for their empires if the government provides a safety net, provides genuine support.
Well, and that's what, I mean, what strikes me so much and what is resonant with me with where we were 100 years ago, basically, is the excesses of early industrialization and the development of sort of the machine age led to a progressive movement. It was, you know, racially biased, but at the same time, you know, made huge strides in sort of workers' rights and sort of the protection of individuals, you know, Food and Drug Administration, you know, Federal Trade Commission, those kinds of things. And then the Great Depression led to the New Deal, the creation of a modern sort of social state, if you will, with responsibilities, government having responsibilities for individual citizens. What we're seeing right now is the recreation of those circumstances. And I'm very optimistic that what's going to emerge out of this is a new progressive New Deal kind of stage of American politics that's going to address these inequities, going to address the what a working wage is, going to address universal health care, going to address the screw up of the voting systems. We're on the cusp of a potential very, very broad progressive movement here in the United States. There's forces fighting against it, but I think those forces are on the losing side.
Well, the status quo always fights harder when things are looking more promising for the other side. I'm hoping also that whatever New Deal comes, unlike Roosevelt's New Deal, it eliminates systemic racism. Roosevelt's New Deal, great though it was, included things like redlining and didn't allow black veterans to participate in the what you call it.
Right. Well, that's what's exciting to me is to see the Black Lives Matter movement is to me has come to represent to me the spearhead and the number of young people of all ethnicities and other folks gathering behind that is very hopeful to me that we'll see some of this.
And I know we're on the way out the door shortly, but I just wanted to reference Letters for Biden from FDR, the David Brooks opinion column on the Monday, August 1st edition of the Seattle Times, which really gets into some suggestions around liberal capitalism. that Biden could pull from FDR. It was an excellent